Chapter 4. This is great. I wonder what will happen.
Oh, youth.
Suddenly man sighted a steamer far astern. Captain Beard said, we may do something with her yet. We hoisted two flags, which set in the international language of the sea, on fire. Want immediate assistance. The steamer grew bigger rapidly, and by spoke with two flags on her foremast, I am coming to your assistance. In half an hour she was abreast, to windward, with an hail, and rolling slightly, with her engine stopped. We lost our composure, and yelled all together with excitement, we've been blown up. A man in a white helmet, on the bridge, cried, yes. All right. And he nodded his head, and smiled, and made soothing motions with his hand, as though at a lot of frightened children. One of the boats dropped in the water, and walked towards us upon the sea with her long oars. Four calashes pulled a swinging stroke. This was my first sight of Malay seamen. I've known them since, but what struck me then was their unconcern. They came alongside, and even the bowman standing up, and holding to our main chains with the boat hook did not deign to lift his head for a glance. I thought people who had been blown up deserved more attention. A little man, dry like a chip and agile like a monkey, clambered up. It was the mate of the steamer. He gave one look, and cried, oh boys, you had better quit. We were silent. He talked apart with the captain for a time, seemed to argue with him. Then they went away together to the steamer. When our skipper came back, we learned that the steamer was the Somerville, Captain Nash, from West Australia to Singapore via Batavia with mails, and that the agreement was she should tow us to Anjer or Batavia, if possible, where we could extinguish the fire by scuttling, and then proceed on our voyage to Bangkok. The old man seemed excited. We will do it yet, he said to man, fiercely. He shook his fist at the sky. Nobody else said a word. At noon the steamer began to tow. She went ahead slim and high, and what was left of the Judea followed at the end of 70 fathom of tow rope, followed her swiftly like a cloud of smoke with mastheads protruding above. We went aloft to furl the sails. We coughed on the yards, and were careful about the bunts. Do you see a lot of us there, putting a neat furl on the sails of that ship doomed to arrive nowhere? There was not a man who didn't think that at any moment the masts would topple over. From aloft we could not see the ship for smoke, and they worked carefully, passing the gaskets with even turns. Harbor furl aloft there. Cried man from below. You understand this? I don't think one of those chaps expected to get down in the usual way. When we did, I heard them saying to each other, well, I thought we would come down overboard, in a lump sticks and all, blame me if I didn't. That's what I was thinking to myself, would answer wearily another battered and bandaged scarecrow. And, mind, these were men without the drilled-in habit of obedience. To an onlooker they would be a lot of profane scallywags without a redeeming point. What made them do it, what made them obey me when I, thinking consciously how fine it was, made them drop the bunt of the foresail twice to try, and do it better? What? They had no professional reputation, no examples, no praise. It wasn't a sense of duty. They all knew well enough how to shirk, and laze, and dodge when they had a mind to it, and mostly they had. Was it the £2.10 a month that sent them there? They didn't think their pay half good enough. No, it was something in them, something inborn and subtle and everlasting. I don't say positively that the crew of a French or German merchant man wouldn't have done it, but I doubt whether it would have been done in the same way. There was a completeness in it, something solid like a principle, and masterful like an instinct, a disclosure of something secret, of that hidden something, that gift, of good or evil, that makes racial difference, that shapes the fate of nations. It was that night at 10 that, for the first time since we had been fighting it, we saw the fire. The speed of the towing had fanned the smoldering destruction. A blue gleam appeared forward, shining below the wreck of the deck. It wavered in patches, it seemed to stir and creep like the light of a glowworm. I saw it first, and told man. Then the game's up, apostrophe he said. We had better stop this towing, or she will burst out suddenly fore and aft, before we can clear out. Apostrophe apostrophe we set up a yell, rang bells to attract their attention. They towed on. At last man and I had to crawl forward, and cut the rope with an axe. There was no time to cast off the lashings. Red tongues could be seen licking the wilderness of splinters under our feet as we made our way back to the poop. Of course they very soon found out in the steamer that the rope was gone. She gave a loud blast of her whistle, her lights were seen sweeping in a wide circle, she came up ranging close alongside, and stopped. We were all in a tight group on the poop looking at her. Every man had saved a little bundle or a bag. Suddenly a conical flame with a twisted top shot up forward, and threw upon the black sea a circle of light, with the two vessels side by side, and heaving gently in its center. Captain Beard had been sitting on the grating still, and mute for hours, but now he rose slowly, and advanced in front of us, to the mizzen shrouds. Captain Nash hailed. Come along. Look sharp. I have mail bags on board. I will take you and your boats to Singapore. Apostrophe apostrophe, thank you. No. Apostrophe said our skipper. We must see the last of the ship. Apostrophe apostrophe, I can't stand by any longer. Apostrophe shouted the other. Males you know. Apostrophe apostrophe, We are all right. Apostrophe, very well. I'll report you in Singapore. Goodbye. Apostrophe apostrophe, he waved his hand. Our men dropped their bundles quietly. The steamer moved ahead, and passing out of the circle of light, vanished at once from our sight, dazzled by the fire which burned fiercely. And then I knew that I would see the East first as commander of a small boat. I thought it fine, and the fidelity to the old ship was fine. We should see the last of her. Oh, the glamour of youth! Oh, the fire of it, more dazzling than the flames of the burning ship, throwing a magic light on the wide earth, leaping audaciously to the sky, presently to be quenched by time, more cruel, more pitiless, more bitter than the sea, and like the flames of the burning ship surrounded by an impenetrable night. The old man warned us in his gentle and inflexible way that it was part of our duty to save for the underwriters as much as we could of the ship's gear. According we went to work aft, while she blazed forward, to give us plenty of light. We lugged out a lot of rubbish. What didn't we save? An old barometer fixed with an absurd quantity of screws nearly cost me my life. A sudden rush of smoke came upon me, and I just got away in time. There were various stores, bolts of canvas, coils of rope, the poop looked like a marine bazaar, and the boats were lumbered to the gunwales. One would have thought the old man wanted to take as much as he could of his first command with him. He was very, very quiet, but off his balance evidently. Would you believe it? He wanted to take a length of old stream cable and a kedge anchor with him in the long boat. We said, sir, apostrophe deferentially, and on the quiet let the thing slip overboard. The heavy medicine chest went that way, two bags of green coffee, tins of paint fancy, paint, a whole lot of things. Then I was ordered with two hands into the boats to make a stowage, and get them ready against the time it would be proper for us to leave the ship. We put everything straight, stepped the long boat's mast for our skipper, who was in charge of her, and I was not sorry to sit down for a moment. My face felt raw, every limb ached as if broken, I was aware of all my ribs, and would have sworn to a twist in the backbone. The boats, fast astern, lay in a deep shadow, and all around I could see the circle of the sea lighted by the fire. A gigantic flame rose forward straight and clear. It flared there, with noises like the whir of wings, with rumbles as of thunder. There were cracks, detonations, and from the cone of flame the sparks flew upwards, as man is born to trouble, to leaky ships, and to ships that burn. What bothered me was that the ship, lying broadside to the swell, and to such wind as there was a mere breath, the boats would not keep astern where they were safe, but persisted, in a pig-headed way boats have, in getting under the counter, and then swinging alongside. They were knocking about dangerously, and coming near the flame, while the ship rolled on them, and, of course, there was always the danger of the masts going over the side at any moment. I and my two boat keepers kept them off as best we could with oars and boat hooks, but to be constantly at it became exasperating, since there was no reason why we should not leave at once. We could not see those on board, nor could we imagine what caused the delay. The boat keepers were swearing feebly, and I had not only my share of the work, but also had to keep at it two men who showed a constant inclination to lay themselves down, and let things slide. At last I hailed on deck there, apostrophe, and someone looked over. "We're ready here, apostrophe," I said. The head disappeared, and very soon popped up again. The captain says, "All right, sir, and to keep the boats well clear of the ship." Apostrophe, apostrophe, half an hour passed. Suddenly there was a frightful racket, rattle, clanking of chain, hiss of water, and millions of sparks flew up into the shivering column of smoke that stood leaning slightly above the ship. The cat heads had burned away, and the two red hot anchors had gone to the bottom, tearing out after them 200 fathom of red-hot chain. The ship trembled, the mass of flame swayed, as if ready to collapse, and the foretop gallant mast fell. It darted down like an arrow of fire, shot under, and instantly leaping up within an oar's length of the boats, floated quietly, very black on the luminous sea. I hailed the deck again. After some time a man in an unexpectedly cheerful, but also muffled tone, as though he had been trying to speak with his mouth shut, informed me, coming directly, "Sir," apostrophe, and vanished. For a long time I heard nothing but the whir and roar of the fire. There were also whistling sounds. The boats jumped, tugged at the painters, ran at each other playfully, knocked their sides together, or, do what we would, swung in a bunch against the ship's side. I couldn't stand it any longer, and swarming up a rope, clambered aboard over the stern. It was as bright as day. Coming up like this, the sheet of fire facing me, was a terrifying sight, and the heat seemed hardly bearable at first. On a settee cushion dragged out of the cabin, Captain Beard, with his legs drawn up and one arm under his head, slept with the light playing on him. Do you know what the rest were busy about? They were sitting on deck right aft, round an open case, eating bread and cheese and drinking bottled stout. On the background of flames twisting in fierce tongues above their heads, they seemed at home like salamanders, and looked like a band of desperate pirates. The fire sparkled in the whites of their eyes, gleamed on patches of white skin seen through the torn shirts. Each had the marks, as of a battle about embandaged heads, tied up arms, a strip of dirty rag round a knee, and each man had a bottle between his legs, and a chunk of cheese in his hand. Man got up. With his handsome and disreputable head, his hooked profile, his long white beard, and with an uncorked bottle in his hand, he resembled one of those reckless sea robbers of old making merry amidst violence and disaster. The last meal on board, apostrophe, he explained solemnly. We had nothing to eat all day, and it was no use leaving all this. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he flourished the bottle, and indicated the sleeping skipper. He said he couldn't swallow anything, so I got him to lie down, apostrophe, he went on. And as I stared, "I don't know whether you are aware, young fellow, the man had no sleep, to speak of 4 days, and there will be damn little sleep in the boats. Apostrophe apostrophe there will be no boats by and by, if you fool about much longer, apostrophe I said, indignantly. I walked up to the skipper, and shook him by the shoulder. At last he opened his eyes, but did not move. Time to leave her, sir, apostrophe I said, quietly. He got up painfully, looked at the flames, at the sea sparkling round the ship, and black, black as ink farther away. He looked at the stars shining dim through a thin veil of smoke in a sky black, black as Erebus. Youngest first, apostrophe he said. And the ordinary seaman, wiping his mouth with the back of his hand, got up, clambered over the taffrail, and vanished. Others followed. One, on the point of going over, stopped short to drain his bottle, and with a great swing of his arm flung it at the fire. Take this. Apostrophe he cried. The skipper lingered disconsolately, and we left him to commune alone for a while with his first command. Then I went up again, and brought him away at last. It was time. The ironwork on the poop was hot to the touch. Then the painter of the longboat was cut, and the three boats, tied together, drifted clear of the ship. It was just 16 hours after the explosion, when we abandoned her. Man had charge of the second boat, and I had the smallest, the 14-foot thing. The longboat would have taken the lot of us, but the skipper said we must save as much property as we could for the underwriters, and so I got my first command. I had two men with me, a bag of biscuits, a few tins of meat, and a breaker of water. I was ordered to keep close to the longboat, that in case of bad weather we might be taken into her. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.